Hello, and welcome to Energy Oracles, a podcast from the creators of Petroleum Economist, Hydro Economist, and Carbon Economist. I'm Paul Hicking, Editor-in-Chief, and I'm joined by editors Stuart Penson and Simon Ferry to discuss what we learned from this year's London International Energy Week. For me, the rebranded IP Week continues to reflect the contradictions and collaborations that the industry is working through. Oil seemed to be simultaneously everywhere and nowhere. The big analytics companies still want to focus on oil and gas, as they are still the big energy drivers and money makers. But certainly the main IE Week event was a vibrant thrum of discussions around the trilemma and how to square the circle on energy and emissions. In fact, even in the events on the sidelines, there seemed to be an emerging, multi-pronged IE Week where green energy events sit next to oil events but have little overlap, which seems to be a break from the all-under-one-umbrella approach that emerged when transition became as big a talking point as hydrocarbons. Stuart, as someone focused on the transition, what have been the big takeaways for you?
Yeah, thanks, Paul. I think probably three main points to take away. Well, so firstly, the sheer challenge, the sheer size of the challenge of the transition really, really came through from delegates at the event. And so if we think about renewables, electrification being the sort of key big first part of the transition, so the pace of the build out of renewables is really quite astonishing, very rapid. Last year we saw about $1.7 trillion of investment going into clean energy in total. And so the amount of renewable power capacity added last year was up about 40% on 2019, and it was about 60% more than the investment going into fossil fuels. So we're looking at about 10% of global electricity now coming from renewables. So this is quite an astonishing expansion, but it's not fast enough. You know, emissions are still rising and energy demand is still rising. So despite that massive expansion of renewables, it wasn't enough to keep pace with energy demand. So as a result, fossil fuel demand continued rising and emissions continued rising. So, I guess this ties back to the sort of COP28 commitment and IEA projections that we need to sort of triple the investment in renewables, even from this very, very high level that we have now. So that was the first thing. The other thing was that came through for me was, so the role of hydrogen, of low carbon hydrogen. It seemed there seems to be a sense that the kind of buzz around hydrogen, the hype that we've seen over the last 2 years, has kind of peaked and sort of leveled off, and we're moving into a bit of a reality check on hydrogen. Now, that's not to say that hydrogen is not going to play a very big role in the transition, but there's definitely a reality check in terms of how it's going to be deployed, how quickly it's going to be deployed, especially in the sort of hard to abate sectors like steel. It's going to take longer than previously thought, and it's going to be more expensive than previously thought, as you know, companies have to sort of reconfigure their whole industrial processes. So really the focus for hydrogen has to be on replacing existing applications of grey hydrogen in sort of fertilizer production and refining. A bit of a reality check on hydrogen. It's not going to suddenly be all over the economy in the next few years. It's going to take a lot of time and a lot of money over the next decade or so. I think the third thing that struck me was the importance of carbon pricing. So carbon pricing via markets, carbon traded markets, cap and trade markets, voluntary markets, all through taxation. So that really was a common thread that ran through all of the discussions. You know, I was quite surprised to learn that about a fifth of the world's emissions now are actually covered by some form of carbon pricing, be that through trading or taxation. So there has been a lot of progress there. There are still issues with the voluntary market, very big issues in terms of credibility of projects that need to be solved. And the pricing in a lot of the actual cap and trade markets, well, certainly in Europe, prices have dropped a lot. So in the EU ETS, prices are down to about 50, 55 euros a ton. In the UK's trading system, prices have sort of hit kind of all-time lows of about £35 a ton. So this does kind of highlight the point that we need much higher carbon prices to enable and to drive carbon capture and storage, for one thing. And, you know, there was a feeling that to really drive CCS, you need sort of 90 to 100 euros a ton or £100 a ton carbon. So it kind of highlighted how important carbon markets are to driving through that deployment of carbon capture and storage, which is a very important part of the transition. Now, I'll sort of finish up those three points by saying, yeah, so the kind of hierarchy of technologies now that certainly that, well, the big oil companies, for example, are using to sort of look at their future scenarios to 2050. So we start off with electrification. And when everything that's electrified can be electrified, then you're moving into green molecules, which includes hydrogen and e-fuels and other fuels, liquid fuels. And then after that, when that's all done, then the carbon capture and carbon removals really kick in to start mopping up the emissions, the sort of residual emissions that are left. So alongside that last bit, you do need a good high enough carbon price to make that happen. So yeah, a massive challenge across the piece, really, was the main takeaway for me.
And it does seem like the elephant in the room really is cost, or the price of everything across the whole transition. I think while everyone talks the policy side, it really does seem like, you know, we could be entering an era of low energy prices being at the end of low energy prices, in a sense, the era of low energy prices. And, you know, if we're really going to make the transition happen, it's a real, I think it's not really been tackled in a way by, it's not really been answered by policymakers in the industry.
Yeah, I think that is the key point. Even if you look at renewables, so wind and solar, the cost of generating wind and solar power has obviously dropped massively. But don't forget that for the build out for renewables, you need massive investment in transmission and distribution networks. So that's a cost that somebody is going to have to pay. Hydrogen, you know, is very expensive to produce, a low carbon hydrogen. Carbon capture and storage is a massively capital intensive project. So I think you're right. I don't think this cost pressure has really been kind of communicated through to the general public, to be honest. And one of the points raised this week, you know, about the transition is that the only way it's going to work is if we bring people along with it. So I think there is a communication challenge. You know, perhaps there's still some sort of leveling to be done with the public on the cost of the transition and then the impact on energy prices.
Yeah, and I think you look at the other thing that comes out of this is the sort of, I'm not sure about contradictions is the right word, but the issue, like the amount of cement, for example, needed to roll out wind farms that they're based around, and cement is a hard to abate sector for emissions, or the mining that around metals that's needed for electric vehicles or some of the other renewables, and and the costs and the other environmental damage that goes into that. It just seems to be, you know, everyone struggling with a holistic approach to handling the transition, especially when oil and gas is at the moment, you know, still relatively reasonable prices. We've just seen, you know, we've avoided any sort of further gas crisis this winter, and now we're in a position where gas prices are falling at a very striking rate, and oil, but at the same token, has been in this kind of arguable sweet spot in the sort of $70 to $80 range, which seems to be a sort of area for consumers and producers alike. It is interesting, and
yeah, I mean the. You're absolutely right. The raw materials required for the transition, you know, rare earth metals, nickel, cobalt, so critical minerals. That's a very big worry. You know, can they actually be extracted and processed in a low carbon way? Because if they can't, then the whole thing gets undermined. So it's make no mistake, the transition is a sort of industrial revolution of its own, and everything that goes with it.
Yeah, I think that's the point, the industrial revolution of its own. And I think also the sort of, it plays out to the whole new geopolitical arena. You know, the different countries are where critical minerals are found. It completely shifts the sort of production and manufacturing dynamic globally. We've seen this situation with the rise of BRICS, which was once a kind of Goldman Sachs marketing term, and has now become this kind of geopolitical entity. And you've got a world that's been marked by crisis in Russia and Ukraine. We're not sure where that's going to go. We've got the Red Sea crisis and the atrocities in Gaza, and the impact that's having on freight rates. And they were talking points across the oil market and the gas markets, i.e. week this week as well. I think from an oil and gas perspective, you've got some big questions around US as a global oil and gas exporter, a huge one, and we've seen question marks around, you know, can shale now repeat the growth? And there's a real divide we saw this week around whether shale can produce the unexpected rise it saw in 2023. Analysts are really split towards potentially almost a million barrels a day of growth in shale from some, to less than 500,000 barrels a day for others. So there is a gap. From that, you've seen, you know, got a rise of Guyana, potential growth in Namibia, Canada still going strong, and Brazil. So there's plenty of non-OPEC supply growth coming on, which is also a big theme. And in a sense, weirdly, the oil market was talking about, you know, are things boring, which it's kind of an unusual situation to be in. The fact that OPEC really wasn't mentioned throughout IE week as a talking point. So while there's a big disparity of views, which I saw at different events, gaps between where demand is going to be because of, it's been at least in the next year or two, given the situation around China and the US in terms of where inflation is going to be, when interest rates are going to start coming down and inflation be truly beaten. But again, the US seems to be defying that on the growth situation. And with China, with its property situation, it's a situation that's not going away. So in a sense, all the themes around the global economy, around China, seem to be there, and almost we're waiting to exhale, waiting for the second half of the year when we've got huge themes around elections in the US, around how much more can OPEC Plus continue to roll over those production cuts, because while we're in a sweet spot, it's taken OPEC a lot of cuts to get there to that sweet spot. And we saw with Angola leaving at the start of the year that there are tensions in the group, that production quotas are going to have to be dealt with at some point through 2024. So they're clearly big issues that the market's going to work through. And like you said, Stuart, we've got the transition as a big issue, and how does the oil and gas industry deal with that? We've seen a lot of consolidation last year with ExxonMobil and Pioneer and Chevron and Hess, a real change in the sort of oil and gas IOC space. And again, rumors of a BP Shell mergers cropping up don't seem to be going away. Talking the Australian sector of mergers as well across the oil and gas space. They seem to surface and go away. So clearly there are things afoot in the industry, and that's changing. And Simon, you were looking at the oil and gas side of things. What were your big themes from IE Week?
Yeah, thanks, Paul. So I suppose one of the key topics of IE Week, really the rise of non-OPEC production growth, right? Most of the growth in oil production 2024, it's going to be coming from non-OPEC sources. We're seeing OPEC and OPEC Plus, their overall share of the global market is being eroded. This year, again, we're going to see more U.S. production. We've seen Guyana already sort of go from very little to over 600,000 barrels already, I believe. More gains expected this year. Additional Canadian production is going to be reaching export markets with the Trans Mountain pipeline and so on. So, yeah, really, that's one of the key stories of IE Week, how that's really changing the dynamics of the oil market. Connected to that as well, again, sort of maybe a persistent theme in recent years has really been a bit of uncertainty about the outlook for macro demand, still economic headwinds, still inflation in many key markets, what this is doing to, just overall energy demand itself. And then, of course, another key topic, obviously been in the news a lot in the last few months, is the issues surrounding Red Sea. The Houthi interdictions that are taking place there. It's been an interesting topic because it's, for as prominent as it is in the news, we're not really seeing price impacts in our key, at least in the markets we're looking at. So oil prices, LNG prices, you're not really seeing volatility generated or still generated off the back of these attacks. In these wider markets, sort of soft fundamentals, really helping sort of limit the impact of these attacks on shipping. But on the other hand, it has resulted in a rerouting of a significant amount of trade, particularly LNG, particularly product. There's a lot of talk of essentially split markets here between Atlantic Basin and Asia Pacific, both the products and crude, with the longer journey times and so on to go around Cape Hope. We are in some ways seeing two not separate markets, obviously linked still, but very much different trends in the two main basins. Related to that, of course, and this sort of ongoing rerouting of trade, we're still discussing, the impacts of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, specifically for our listeners, obviously the ongoing sanctions, the deepening sanctions, the G7 price cap, how these are still, after two years into the conflict in Ukraine, these are still having huge impacts on the energy markets. Although, of course, acknowledgement that plenty of Russian crude has been sold above the price cap levels, and Russia has also been able to secure, these much greater market share in China, new and very significant market share in India. So that's still moving on, with, of course, attendant impacts on freight and the tanker markets. Say a significant amount of the tanker global tanker fleet is employed in either sanctioned or potentially sanctioned trade, be it Russian barrels, be it Venezuelan barrels, be it Iranian crude and condensate. So that's a key topic for anyone looking at freight. Another great uncertainty this year, and a trend that everyone's keeping an eye on, of course, is the vast amount of new refinery capacity, which is either scheduled or potentially could come on this year. not just come on this year, but ramp up this year. So obviously a lot of interest in Dangote in Nigeria. You know, how much that's actually capable of producing now, what rate it will be able to ramp up, and whether or not the refinery, the enormous refinery there, what, 650,000 barrels capacity, whether that will be able to produce at its full nameplate capacity this year. That's another key issue, particularly for anyone looking at the Atlantic Basin gasoline markets, European refiners and so on. So that key, those, yeah, and we're also seeing, of course, there's still refinery capacity coming online in China, I believe in Shandong, Middle East. We've got some of those huge facilities ramping up still, I believe, Al Zour, for example. And then on the liquefied, liquefied natural gas side, this year marks a sort of a little bit of a deceleration, I suppose, in the commissioning of new capacity. We are going to still see some incremental gains in LNG production capacity, but we're not seeing any of the huge volumes that have come on in recent years. Although, again, later this decade, we will see more of the large projects, coming online. So, that's interesting because we've got, again, incremental LNG production capacity growth against the backdrop, as with the oil markets discussed earlier, this sort of uncertainty about macro demand levels and some of the economic headwinds, not just in Europe, but China and other key markets. So there was a lot of talk. And again, a lot of those themes that we've really been seeing the last few years, right? The importance now in the oil and gas markets of sanctions, of geopolitics. Obviously, the Red Sea, the incidents in the Red Sea and the concerns about sending shipping through that vital, passage, that's new. But we've already seen the markets in the last few years absorbing pretty, very radical shifts in trade flows, right? So again, that's a sort of ongoing thing this year. Obviously, the refining projects, a lot of these are, we've been keeping an eye on some of these for years. So again, that's not exactly a new trend. And OPEC versus non-OPEC, again, the emergence of the US as largest producer of crude and LNG has been a huge shift in the market in the last few years. It's really coming into prominence now. So yeah, a lot of very big topics this under discussion this year at IE Week.
Thanks, Simon. I think just to touch on a couple of things you raised, which I thought were really important, is this reconfiguring of the energy map. We're seeing it with the transition space, with how critical minerals and where new supply of energy is going to come from, but also within the oil space or within the gas space, how it's being reconfigured. The idea that refinery, where oil products are to come from, is moving from Europe and the West. It's been a trend that's culminating in shifts to Asia and China and Africa. This reconfiguring of flows and who owns the resources of oil products, which is so significant for the industry. The idea about, I think the other interesting thing is that this gap or disparity and these views, this uncertainty, yet throughout all this uncertainty, the consensus in the market and in the industry is so narrow, and even prices have stayed stable, which is kind of a very odd situation to be in. The idea that, the outlook for demand in the next couple of years is the gap between the IEA and the OPEC forecast over 1 million barrels a day for demand, given the uncertainty around China and the US, etc. It's really intriguing. The idea around the gap between how much non-OPEC supply is going to come on, how much US production is going to grow this year. Again, it's the disparity of figures, more than 500,000 barrel a day gap again in how much that supply could be. And maybe that's a function of price and where OPEC Plus have kept the market. But at the same time, are we going to stay in this sort of $75-$80 sweet spot? And I think, I think going back to Stuart here now, and maybe you can elaborate a little bit further, the idea is this tension between security of supply versus the transition space, what's this mean, you know, coming out of COP28 as well, where gas was a kind of, you know, people found it hard to sort of really pinpoint where gas fits into the transition and the energy and emissions question. So I don't know, you know, your thoughts, Stuart, on some of these big topics.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of Europe, obviously this security of supply issue had a massive impact on policy, really, in the last couple of years. So, and there has been a kind of, you know, a bit of a rolling back on the sort of pace of the transition in some respects. I think the European Union has taken the view or tried to take the view that things like hydrogen can play a sort of twin role of decarbonisation and providing new security of supply. But that's quite a tricky theory, given how slowly hydrogen supply is actually coming to the market and how few projects are actually reached FID and actually materialised. So it is we talk about the trilemma and that is still very much there. You know, how affordable is energy going to be, how secure is it going to be, and how fast is the decarbonisation going to be. I mean, it interesting, there was quite a lot of talk in IE Week about the developing countries and how they, you know, how they view the transition and their kind of pushback a bit in terms of having the kind of developed world view or model of the transition imposed on them, because, you know, they're at such a different stage. They're, you know, if you look at most developed economies, you know, energy demand is essentially flat, whereas, you know, obviously if you go into, you know, India and other developing economies, it's energy demand is going through the roof. So there's a whole totally different dynamic in terms of, well, in terms of building out energy supply quickly enough to keep pace with demand. And, you know, renewables, you know, somebody was talking about Indian renewable expansion, which is pretty ambitious, very, very rapid, but it's not rapid enough to keep pace with energy demand. So fossil fuels need to play a demand. And yet, let's not forget, you know, these economies, they're trying to give more people access to electricity, critically important, and the sort of socio-economic aspects. So, the sort of EU transition model doesn't really fly.
Yeah, and I think that's the two big mantras, isn't it? From less of the global south, for want of a better word, is, you know, we need to industrialize before we can decarbonize, has been the kind of the message that's come out of those quarters. And also, I guess the other big elephant in the room is that, you know, this sort of link between economic growth and development and energy, and, you know, can renewables and the non-fossil fuels plug the sort of enormous growth that you're talking about, Stuart? It's a real, still a big question. I don't probably think it was probably talked about enough at IE Week, in a sense. But yeah, Simon, if you know, what's some of your other thoughts on what you're seeing around IE Week?
Well, actually, if I could just jump in on that transition topic there. I mean, you know, I especially looking at oil and gas projects in Africa, I think African governments are increasingly sort of assertive about you know, being able to tap their own resources and for the benefit of you know, their own peoples and, you know, their own economies. You look at a country like Uganda, which has faced you know, there has been protests in the West and criticism in the West about the East Africa crude oil pipeline project, which will be taking Ugandan crude via Tanzania to the Indian Ocean coast. You know, and this is something Kampala sees as a key project for its development, for its economy, and for its prospects in the coming years. And as they point out, Africa produces a fraction of global emissions. So I think historically something like 2% of carbon emissions, you know, there's something like two thirds, 600 million people with that access to regular access to electricity and so on. So there's an enormous energy supply deficit there in Africa. I think that really has to be taken into account by commentators in the West when they talk about, you know, this new project's a carbon bomb or this sort of thing. It's it's a little unfair when we already have the benefits of we're already enjoying the benefits of the energy industry and so, you know, established supply chains and all these sort of things. And we take that, it really is a question, I think, in so many ways, of taking it for granted.
Yeah, no, it's a fair point, Simon. Energy complacency seems to be another big theme, given the security questions at the backdrop and the transition questions at in the backdrop at the same time. I think we'll leave it there. I think very interesting in terms of IE Week. It seems to be the idea of the market-driven oil and gas markets versus the kind of bigger picture, big themes of the transition and what's going on in terms of electrification, the hydrogen industry, and beyond. So it does feel like there's a kind of a two-speed International Energy Week now rather than a kind of one-size-fits-all approach. And I just want to thank Stuart Penson and Simon Ferry for their thoughts for this week. And please check out Petroleum Economist, Hydro Economist, and Carbon Economist. Thanks for listening.